from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Apropos of this election week, Soundings now presents the first of two discussions about presidential politics with three social historians, William Luchtenberg, David McCullough, and Otis Graham. William Luchtenberg and Otis Graham are professors at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. William Luchtenberg is the author of In the Shadow of FDR, a narrative history that traces the political legacy of Franklin Roosevelt from Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan. Otis Graham is the author of Toward a Planned Society, a book that follows American social and economic growth between the presidencies of FDR and Richard Nixon. David McCullough's books include Mornings on Horseback, a narrative history of the family and background of Theodore Roosevelt. Mr. McCullough is presently at work on a biography of Harry Truman. What is the legacy of FDR that Ronald Reagan inherits? How would you characterize it?
Well, I think there are a number of things that make Franklin Roosevelt particularly attractive to Ronald Reagan, despite the fact they have very different ideological frameworks. First of all, Franklin Roosevelt is the first Democrat to enter the White House with as much as 50% of the vote in 80 years, the first since Franklin Pierce. And he brings to an end an era of Republican rule and creates a political revolution with the Democrats as the country's majority party. Ronald Reagan would like to do the same thing for the Republican Party. Secondly, Ronald Reagan sees FDR as being the author of an exceptionally successful foreign policy. And he would like to be the architect of a very different kind of foreign policy to reorient the world in other directions. And finally, Ronald Reagan sees Franklin Roosevelt as a man who, in sponsoring the New Deal, reoriented American attitudes toward economic policy, toward domestic programs, and he has already begun in his first term, in the first year of his first term, to reorient the American public toward turning away from New Deal attitudes and in a different direction. But though he departs from him on ideas, on policies, he sees himself or hopes that he will be that same kind of historic figure who turns things around.
Seems to me, Bill, that one of the strong aspects of sympathetic feeling between Reagan and FDR is that they're both great optimists, at least in their public manner. They're exuberant optimists, and they're both superb on the microphone. They are both acutely aware of the fact that if the need comes, they can go over the head of the Congress or whomever is in the way by taking to the airwaves.
It's interesting to compile a list of the ways in which they are similar. It can go on quite a distance before you then have to work the other side, the ways in which they aren't at all.
Absolutely.
But if I could add to that list of the ways in which they are alike, and you learn a lot of this from Bill's book, and it starts you thinking hard about Reagan's interpretation of that history and that legacy. They're about the same size. They were governors of the largest state. They have this communication ability and this sense of optimism, and that list gets rather long. Bill goes through it for us, as well as works the other side. Let me start the other side, which to me is the most impressive and the most important for us not to forget and lose sight of. This isn't necessarily the top of the list, and I think the list is important of ways in which they are very dissimilar people. I find them ideologically anchoring the extreme ends of the workable American mainstream of politics. Roosevelt is just on the left edge of mainstream presidential politics in our history, and Reagan is on the right, and their attitude towards something fundamental like the American marketplace and the role of the state is just profoundly different. A second difference is that Roosevelt was a serious student of government, and his mastery of detail was superb. Reagan has a very different sense of how hard you have to work about the details.
Well, Otis, Reagan is always quoting a particular passage of FDR's in which he talks about how enfeebling it is to give people what today we would call welfare. And he is able particularly to quote a sentence in which Roosevelt says that the government must and shall quit this business of relief. What Reagan leaves out of that is that this is part of FDR's then going on to recommend the greatest single peacetime appropriation in the history of this or any other country in order to provide work for the unemployed. And what one misses altogether in Reagan is any sense at a time when at various times have been 8-9% of the workforce unemployed, that the government has a responsibility to see that they have useful employment. And that's something, too, that FDR strongly believed.
They both campaigned and got elected in part because of their strong promise to balance the budget. And each of them ran up the largest deficit in history up to that point. These similarities are really, they're fun to talk about, and they're somewhat ironic and in some cases surprising. But they're superficial. These are two very different human beings.
They are. They are. And in my own reflections on what is the core of the thinking of the two, and how this core is very different. In Roosevelt's case, the core is conservation, as I see it. He called himself a tree farmer or a farmer on various occasions, and he loved to manage that estate and to plant trees. And he was a great tree planter, and he was a man who understood. At a relatively high level, a very high level for political people, he understood watersheds. He understood ecology, though they didn't use that term. And it was the anchor of his thinking, the fabric of his thinking, and he had learned from the conservation movement, the gospel of conservation, as they called it. And that affection for trees and that sense of how the natural environment is tied, not only the inanimate and the animate parts of nature tied, but that humanity is tied forever, its well-being is tied to its stewardship of the land. That's not only crucial to Roosevelt, but in Reagan's case, so profoundly different. And I think that can't be said enough as the beginning point of the difference of their view of what the society is and where it is headed.
I agree with that. And at the same time, there's a puzzle about Reagan. Reagan says, as David was pointing out, that he ran for, he supported FDR when FDR ran for president in 1932 because FDR then favored balancing the budget, which Reagan has always advocated. And Reagan says at times, you know, I haven't changed. It's the Democrats who've changed. I still believe in what FDR said in 1932. The only trouble with that is, as has been pointed out, he also voted for FDR in 1936, in 1940, and 1944, all four times. Beyond that, he was an active member of Americans for Democratic Action, the leading liberal organization of the period. And in 1948, he headed Hollywood's Labor League for Truman for re-election. As late as 1950, he supports Helen Gehagen Douglas against Richard Nixon in the campaign for the United States Senate. And for a time, the Douglas people, Helen Gehagen Douglas being one of the outstanding liberal congressmen of the period, the Douglas people thought of making Reagan their honorary chairman and decided against it because he had too left-wing a reputation.
And certainly there was no transformation of that kind in the life of Franklin Roosevelt.
No, you don't get that kind of change. And then the question is why? I mean, where Reagan went through, this is all of his maturing years as a political figure. As David was noting before, he was closely linked to the New Deal in ways that lots of other people were not. It was the New Deal that saved his family, gave his father a job with a relief agency. His father went out campaigning for FDR in 1932, and the head of the WPA in Ronald Reagan's hometown, Dixon, Illinois, was Ronald Reagan's father. And I recall, David, you're telling me that when you spoke to the president, he talked with enormous enthusiasm about what the WPA had done.
Oh, he said, I could take you there today and show you the park and the airport and all that had been done. It was great pride in that.
I've read both you gentlemen's thoughts and reportage of the way President Reagan makes use of the parts of the Roosevelt legacy he likes and tends to forget the parts he doesn't like. And I think we have two theories that we have to choose between in explaining this. One is that he has learned something that Harry Truman and the others didn't learn through the course of your book. The memory of what Roosevelt had been bedeviled other presidents. They had difficulty with it. Reagan, it seems to me, one theory is that he understands this and he has simply redefined Roosevelt, and he knows that enough time has passed that his redefinition is not going to be very well challenged. His memory is as good as anybody else's, perhaps a bit better. And that personal reinterpretation may be an act of genius. You can borrow from the great man where you wish, and the parts that don't fit, you simply sidestep. That's one theory. The other theory is, I suppose, that instead of in a sophisticated act of reinterpretation, instead of that, it's just that's what he remembers, and he tends to forget what he tends to forget.
Well, I was speaking to the legislative aide of a United States senator a few months ago, and I offered both of these theories and a few more, and I said, what do you make of it? And she said, or all of the above. And with Reagan, that may be possible. But certainly what he's done has been successful. In taking over the Roosevelt imagery, no matter how it infuriates people who know that he's distorting history.
Why do you say successful, Bill? I'm interested that you would say that. There's been a chorus of criticism from historians and other people, perhaps back a bit from the qualifications. There's been complaint in the media. Why do you say that he's pulled this one off?
I think he's pulled it off because, unlike Barry Goldwater, with whom he shares essentially the same outlook, he talks in the idiom of the Democratic Party. He even uses FDR's language of having a rendezvous with destiny. And this makes it much easier for Democrats, for independents, for those who feel they owe a great deal to Roosevelt and the New Deal, and yet have changed their views about the proper role of welfare recipients and others in society, to go along. They don't have to make that jump. And I think the success is seen in the polls and some of the votes that he's had in Congress. But we still have to explain why it is that this man for 20 years was in fact a Roosevelt New Dealer and turned away from it.
Was there some deciding experience, some light on the road to Damascus? I mean, did something happen to him in his life?
There are some theories, and nobody has any documentary evidence that really supports one or the other. One theory is that the crucial development was his marriage to Nancy Reagan, which, among other things, brought him into the orbit of Nancy Reagan's stepfather, Loyal Davis, an arch-conservative Chicago surgeon. There is another view that in some fashion it's related to his experience as president of the Screen Actors Guild and his disillusionment with the communist element within the union. The only trouble with that theory is that he was allied with some of the leading liberal figures in opposing the communists in the union, and his chief biographer discounts the Nancy Davis theory. There's another notion that when he was making the film The Hasty Heart in England, that he had an unhappy time with the British Labour government. And there are still others who would say, and perhaps not wide of the mark, that Reagan, despite the fact that he had a liberal record, was never a man profoundly committed to any particular cause, was not well read, never has been, and so could easily move from one position to another, that when he was asked to head the General Electric Theater, he was also asked to tour General Electric plants around the country. When he did so, he started more and more giving a message that the people at the plants hoped he would give, and that Ronald Reagan has always believed what he said. And he found himself saying this more and more, finally to the point that he became an embarrassment to GE because one of its chief customers was the Tennessee Valley Authority. And Reagan was going farther than his employer wanted. Now, I spun out most of the explanations. I don't find any of them terribly satisfactory, and I'm quite willing to believe that there's yet another explanation.
But am I wrong to hear in your set of a common thread through your theories, all of whom undoubtedly have, well, they're going to organize the researchers of the future, I hope, the fresh, optimistic, and well-received message of the day is one which he's been associated with. The New Deal liberalism was, people were responding so positively, and as an orator and as a person who likes to speak and lead in that sense, he's been in both phases before he's been associated with a message that was being received with a degree of emotion and acceptance and welcome that was fervent. And is that a thread that may connect the two periods? The ideologies and the ideas change, but the audience was glad to hear the good news in both cases, and the good news switched from the left to the right, at least given his audiences, perhaps.
Yeah, he certainly is congruent with the changing moods. One of the things that suggests is that there may be a great deal of a manipulative quality in Reagan, that he calculatedly knows what he's doing in using the Roosevelt symbolism as he has. I'm not altogether persuaded of that. I think he truly does hold Franklin Roosevelt in very considerable esteem. And the fact that he can say a lot of things that distorts history does not, to my mind, prove that he is deliberately doing so for his own advantage. I don't see him as all that Machiavellian.
Woodrow Wilson said of William Jennings Bryan, I believe, "Yes, he's sincere, all right. That's what makes him so dangerous."
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first of two discussions about the modern American presidency, with particular attention to the political legacy of Franklin Roosevelt. The panelists are three social and political historians, William Luchtenberg and Otis Graham of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and David McCullough. William Luchtenberg and Otis Graham have written books about modern presidential politics. David McCullough is at work on a biography of Harry Truman. Let me ask you to reflect on the two presidencies that we have on the table here, FDR and Ronald Reagan, in these terms. To what degree are these men original thinkers? To what degree do they bring truly original ideas to the presidency?
Well, I'll jump right in because I don't know very much about it, therefore I'm eager to answer.
David McCullough.
I would say that they are not original thinkers, particularly. I think they were great at addressing the problem. I think Roosevelt was great at addressing the problem at hand and to working out solutions that worked. And certainly he was gifted at keeping people around him jumping all the time, never quite knowing where they stood. And he rather liked, I suspect, the Byzantine palace quality that the White House acquired during his reign. I think both are very skillful politicians, and I think one of the reasons that Ronald Reagan has been so successful as a politician is that his opponents consistently, time and again, underestimate him because they keep thinking of him as an actor. He isn't an actor. He's a very good politician. But I don't think that implies or necessarily requires originality of thinking or an innovative spirit.
I think so. I think maybe I would come down a little bit more strongly even on that. It has been commonplace, even among people who are FDR admirers, to think of him as an intellectual lightweight. And yet he was an extraordinarily well-informed man. He had a kind of quiz show kid's mind. He could do things like, he had parlor games. Somebody would say to him, here are two American cities, and he would name every county line you would cross. He knew all the islands in the world.
He was a collector.
He was a collector. But I would say two other things about him. One is that, sure, he was not an original thinker. It's hard to think of an American president who was, or many public figures who were. But you find as far back as about 1912, he had an extraordinarily well-developed sense of the state, and particularly related, as you were saying, Otis, to the notion of conservation and the matrix of ideas associated with that. That's quite unusual for an American president. And the other thing is that though we give a lot of attention to the brain trust and the intellectual advisors around FDR, it is striking how many of the ideas of the New Deal derive either altogether from FDR or for whom he is the chief author. I think of everything ranging from the shelter belt, the idea of planting a wide band of trees, millions of trees from the Canadian border to the Texas panhandle, to the idea of lend-lease. And knowing how to frame that idea in homely terms of lending your garden hose to your next door neighbor. So the if you say, is he innovative or is he an original thinker, you have to also say, compared to whom? And if I compare him not simply to Calvin Coolidge or Millard Fillmore, but to the range of better thought of American presidents, I'd have to say that he ranks pretty highly for his intellectual acumen.
FDR. Very, very high.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you to consider this, gentlemen. How would you characterize the presidencies of FDR and Ronald Reagan in terms of the men and the women who surround the president? How important is that?
Well, I'd like to make one observation on that. I think it's a terrible shame that the presidents don't draw more on the expertise and experience of former presidents. I think it's a great waste. We have that investment in their experience and their time in office.
Well, why doesn't this happen?
It doesn't seem to happen. And Roosevelt's, FDR's treatment of Herbert Hoover was really bordered on disgraceful. I think one of the nicest things Harry Truman did was to bring Herbert Hoover into the White House. I mean, literally, physically, and to reinstate the man's dignity.
Hoover hadn't said the things about Harry that he'd said about Franklin.
Well, to be sure. But I think that Reagan's lack of communication with President Carter is a mistake. Not to mention the two presidents from his own party. As far as the immediate people around him, I think they're light years in difference. The Roosevelt people, as Bill can speak to better than anybody, were an extraordinary cast.
Well, you were asking what did we think about the men and women who were brought in, and it was interesting that you phrased it that way, because one of the striking things about Franklin Roosevelt is that he is the first person to name a woman to the cabinet. Frances Perkins, the Secretary of Labor. And though he did not make nearly enough use of the able women there were in the country, his appointment of women to a high office was remarkable, quite unprecedented. The first woman ambassador, for example, is named by Franklin Roosevelt. Up until FDR's time, the national government in Washington had largely been a WASP operation, an operation of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and one could say white Anglo-Saxon Protestant men. That changes under FDR. And the symbol of the change is the famous team of White House advisors, Cochran and Cohn. Tommy Cochran and Ben Cohn, the Irish Catholic from Rhode Island, the Jew from Indiana. So that you find a hospitality to a variety of ethnic groups. You have under FDR, although his record on civil rights was not nearly as good as one would wish it had been, nonetheless, the creation of the Black Cabinet, which is a loose term for the sizable number of able blacks like William Hastie, who were Robert Weaver, Mary McLeod Bethune, who were brought into government appointments either as in official capacity or as advisors. All of this is derives from FDR. And one other thing, too, the whole notion of bringing intellectuals into government. Now, I think by the time of the Vietnam era, we weren't always sure that having the brightest people in the country was necessarily a guarantee to wise government policy. But certainly, the bringing of a generation of college professors, people from law schools, highly trained people into government policy-making position. That gave an elan to government which it simply had not had in the Republican 1920s.
Can you imagine, Bill, Roosevelt even hearing with patience, let alone saying something attributed to Ronald Reagan. The best minds and the best people aren't in government. If they were, private industry would hire them away.
Yeah. David McCullough?
It seems to me, first of all, these two men, Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, have demonstrated, as perhaps no other presidents of the century, with the possible exceptions of Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, that it certainly does make a difference who is president of the United States. Roosevelt, it seems to me, gave this country the confidence that we could address ourselves successfully to huge, overwhelming problems. The first was the Depression, the second was the Second World War. And if you look at what Ronald Reagan is usually saying about Franklin Roosevelt, that's what he's saying. Nobody said we could produce X many airplanes. Franklin Roosevelt stood in the middle of the square in Detroit and said, we will produce so many airplanes, and they all laughed at him. And I've forgotten what the numbers are. And Ronald Reagan loves to quote that. And by golly, you know, we produced those airplanes. That's a tonic, and that's good medicine in any era. In any time. I think Ronald Reagan's most successful performance since he has been president was his handling of the attempted assassination. And there's a wonderful parallel there between Roosevelt's handling of his physical affliction. This was gallantry in the face of tragedy, of pain, of mortality. And Ronald Reagan came out of that experience a new president in the eyes of very many people, I think. And there's a similarity there between the two men. But the notion that both of these men were so kicked by fate and carried it off with no self-pity, none.
I agree with what you say, that Reagan's performance was admirable through all of this, and that this certainly served to give a wave of support for him, both in among the public and in Congress, and helped him put through that program. The economic program, though, that he did put through, one also has to remember, has been one that has proved severely disadvantageous to a lot of the most poverty-stricken people in this country. So that in any long-range assessment of what is memorable about the Reagan years, that too has to be borne in mind. And it's for that reason that I'm less persuaded that he is going to have any kind of place in history roughly approximating that of an FDR.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first of two discussions about the modern American presidency, with special attention to the political legacy of Franklin Roosevelt. The panelists were three social historians, William Luchtenberg and Otis Graham of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and David McCullough. Next week on Soundings, the discussion continues with attention to the influences of FDR upon his successor, Harry Truman. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the first of two discussions about the modern American presidency, with particular attention to the political and social legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The panelists are three social historians, William Luchtenberg and Otis Graham of the University of North Carolina, and David McCullough. This week, the conversation focuses on Professor Luchtenberg's book, In the Shadow of FDR, published last year by Cornell University Press. The Political Legacy of FDR and the American Presidency, Part 1, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station,